Hi, Dr. Keisha. Thank you so much for being part of the Trauma and Mind Body Super Conference.
I'm so glad to be here. What a great title for a conference.
Thank you so much. Now, we're going to talk about sex, but you're a doctor of sexology, which is really fascinating, and this is a really important topic. But so I wanted to ask you first your own story and how you got to become a doctor of sexology and your own history with that and how you got interested in it.
Yeah, whenever I give lectures to functional medicine doctors or other providers on stages, I always say, best doctorate ever, by the way. You know, and everyone always asks, like, I didn't even know that existed, right? And what was happening, and I'll tell my personal story in a minute, but how I even got a PhD in sexology was because I was having all these people come into my office and sit down and say, Dr. Keisha, I want bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. I think my hormones are out of whack. I read all this on the internet. It fits me. Or you gave bioidentical progesterone to my sister, mother, daughter, and they feel fabulous, and I want some of that. And so I would always, listen and then say, okay, so tell me what's going on for you. And I was hearing a lot of low libido, like my libido is just gone and left me. And then when I would start asking very, very simple questions that came out of my own curiosity, okay, so do you like your sex partner? I would often get people crying. My husband had an affair 5 years ago. I've forgiven him, but I don't really want to have sex with him anymore. The trust has been broken. Or my partner got laid off or got a promotion, or I have a special needs child, or like just on and on and on. And I started realizing that none of this had to do with bioidentical hormones. And I would say that, I would say, progesterone and estrogen don't really help that. And then I would hear things like, I never have had a libido level that I was satisfied. When I would ask, when's the last time you had a sex drive that you were happy with? Again, tears, like never. And so then I would say the same thing, this isn't magic. The hormones are not going to suddenly have something reappear that was never there in the first place. And so I started looking in the medical research for what I was seeing, and I couldn't find anything, So I thought, okay, I need to do a study and see what's happening here. And so I went back to school, and my doctoral research was a study that I did called Healing Unresolved Trauma, the HURT study. And what came out of that was the HURT model. And we can discuss that later, but when I was in it and I was working with these women, I started realizing, oh, this happened to me too. Like, because at the time that I was doing the study, I was probably 40. And 10 years prior to that, I had been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis and my libido level had gone, just poof, gone. And I remember looking back at that and going, oh, yeah. It was like the first thing to leave and the last thing to come back. And so let's take a look at that, because 10 years prior I'd actually gotten underneath why I had RA, and that had involved childhood trauma, which included sexual abuse, and I was 10, and I had done a lot of work around that, a lot of trauma release work, a lot of work, and within 6 months my RA was gone. So I've never had it in 25 years since that point. But I started seeing reflected back to me the same pattern I was seeing in all my patients who were having hormone issues. And I started realizing, like, the HURT model actually addressed much more than just low sexual desire in women and their relationship to themselves and sensuality and sexuality. And we can talk about all of that. It actually was pervasive, with how their relationship with themselves in all aspects of life. And that actually, in the HURT model, I have a, you have your initial hurt, in which we can talk about what that means, and then what it does to your nervous system, how it imprints into your body, the meaning you put with it, the belief you create, and the behavior that you create as an adaptive strategy for that. That happens initially in childhood, and then it continues all the way through your life until you get some kind of wake-up call. Maybe it's a disease, maybe it's multiple divorces, maybe it's, not being able to hold down a job or a good relationship with anybody in your life, no matter what it is, it's some kind of call to action where you have to kind of sit up and go, okay, wait a second. I think I might be involved in this somehow, right? There might be something in a pattern that I'm also participatory with. And so on the hurt model, you know, it has these two branches that say, okay, so if you keep doing things the way that you learned how to do them as a traumatized child, which I call maladaptive memory processing looping, you will continue to have the same nervous system response, the same patterns, and then that will lead to a degradation of your health and in all kinds of different ways, mental, emotional, and physical. And then over here, you actually get an opportunity to go, well, hang on, I think I need to maybe do some self-confrontation here. I think I need to look and see where I fit into my own pattern. And maybe this adaptive memory process that I created when I was 4 years old isn't serving me at the age of 40. And maybe I can go do something about that, you know, and that trauma work, and I call it reflection and mirroring, that processing of rewiring and reframing then actually can stop that whole looping so that you can evolve into your next stage of development. And this is actually amazing because it changes things in the bedroom with yourself and others. It changes things in the boardroom. It changes the way that your body manifests into the world, you know, and what you can accomplish. And so it's really, really an amazing way of being in terms of saying, okay, what's not working for me is probably my greatest teacher right now. Let's do it. And let's start doing some integration work around this. And that includes sexually.
It's brilliant. It's so interesting to talk about this topic with you. I think a lot of people with, you know, different chronic illnesses, they don't go straight to thinking about how sexually alive do you feel? How sexually expressed are you? It's the last thing that they might think of thinking about. And yet it's, for my experience as well, my own experience, I think the level of sort of trauma around this, the distortions, the unhealthiness around sex in general, and especially women with you know, kind of the history of so many women around sex, and even if it's not sexual abuse, but just how they were treated, it's epidemic. I think it's an absolute epidemic level. And it's not loving themselves at its core. If you can't have a really healthy, sort of loving sexual relationship with other people and yourself, it's a key piece, right?
It's true. I call it that your libido level is another vital sign that's as important as your blood pressure, your eyesight, your heart rate, and the weight that your scale is giving you. You know, I mean, it's all just data, right?
Yes.
And so one of the things that helped me reverse my rheumatoid arthritis was really delving into other frameworks and paradigms of seeing the body. And I found Ayurvedic medicine. And you know, this is a 10,000-year-old framework of science that is the sister science of yoga. It comes out of India, all written in Sanskrit, so it has funky terminology that's hard for people to wrap their heads around. But it made so much sense to me because one of the very first things that I read was, we're not all the same. You know, and I was an ICU nurse. And, you know, like you talk about cookbook medicine, there's protocol and triaging and decision trees you're making all the time, right? This happens, you do this. This happens, you do this. And so this way of saying, oh, we're not the same. That was, I know it sounds so ridiculous, but it was so revolutionary to me. And it really opened up something for me to consider that, oh, we have to feed and water and take ourselves for walks differently from each other. And we have this balance of what they call doshas, or, you know, our whole body typology around our metabolism and our mental health and our spirituality is all contained inside our pulse, actually. And it's all very different. And that began a nice, you know, string of curiosity for me that got me diving pretty deeply into it. And one of the things that I uncovered was that autoimmune disease is undigested anger. And I remember thinking, like, putting those two words together, digesting anger, just didn't make any sense, you know, in the Western model of medicine. That's not something you would see, right? But it made a lot of sense when I started thinking about it, like, oh, our experiences that we've had, any event in our entire lives has to be digested. And the way that Ayurveda conceptualizes digestion is that your tissue layers, you know, are created from the proper digestion of what just happened before. And it goes down, 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 down into these seven layers. And if one of them doesn't do a great job, then it's like copying a copy on a Xerox, right? You're not going to have really great quality. And so by the time you get down to your reproductive layer, which is the very innermost layer, then you have to have had really fantastic digestion of everything ahead. And that's your food, and it's your feelings and emotions and experiences and memories. And, you know, like all of it has to be digested. And so I've given a lot of talks about Ayurveda and how this emotional world works from that perspective and how that affects your body. And it's beautiful. It's just this beautiful way that they thought about it. And so I started really working with that, like, okay, so I had sexual abuse when I was 10. The vice principal of my elementary school sexually abused me. And I, at that point, made up a meaning to attach to it, because he said, this is because you're a bad kid. I was one of two white kids in an all-black school, and that I was white trash. And so he said, you know, this is because you're bad. And at my age, I thought, oh, I must be doing something wrong, you know, to deserve this then. And so the meaning I made up was that first of all, authority figures can't quite be trusted. You should see me in TSA. I'm very watchful.
Right. Yeah.
There's still okay. A holdover on that authority thing.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the belief that I put in place there was that I actually need to be perfect to survive. Not just to get loved or feel worthy, but to actually stay alive, right? That I have to be perfect. And so the adaptive behavior that I created from that was absolute, like, unquestioning perfectionism, right?
Wow.
Which is a completely unsustainable way of living.
So, okay, yes.
Yeah, by the time I got to be 30, I was a perfect wife, a perfect mother of four kids. I ran marathons. I of course qualified for Boston with my first marathon because I drove myself to this intense training program that, you know, I mean, everything. I was the top of everything, right? And that wasn't because I felt like I needed to show up. It was because I felt like I needed to survive.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So at that point, I wind up with this autoimmune disease, which is me killing me, literally, right?
Yep.
So there's no way that sexual abuse would have interfered with my love life and my sex life at that point, because that would not have been perfect. So it was all shut away in this little box, right? Really far away. And then I got rheumatoid arthritis. And at that point, I'd had all kinds of little things in the decade prior. You know, it takes like 30 years, 10 to 30 years to develop a full-blown autoimmune disease. So my body had been talking along the way, and I had been just suppressing everything, you know, Accutane for acne and lots of ibuprofen for pain when I was marathoning, you know, and injuries and just, oh yeah. I was such a no pain, no gain person. And so it had to be this like, fatal, terminal, there's no cure disease that finally got my attention. And that's the beauty of all this. Like if we don't listen when things are really quiet and we don't pay attention to what's going on, you know, sexually, physically, with our weight, with our jobs, with all of these things, then things will just continue to ramp up. So it was at that point that I said, oh, this sexual abuse, all those years ago, it was like I had a turkey timer in me. It took exactly 20 years to develop a disease that was going to kill me. And it was like this little timer went, ping, you're done, right? And wow. I had to do something about it. I had to, or otherwise I was going to be on all kinds of medications and just a different life and a different person than I had been before that my kids were accustomed to.
That's really, it's also, it's a really amazing story, the connection between where that's where it started. That was the root, the true root cause in your view. That was what happened to you at 10 was the root cause.
Well, we talked when I did the reverse autoimmune disease summit, I interviewed you, and we also talked about this attachment stuff that I had going on at birth too, which, you know, of course led to probably my inability to tell people about the sexual abuse at 10 because I tried. But I didn't, it was 1975, and I was raised with no television. I was a Navy brat, and I actually don't even think I knew the word sex. I don't even think I did. I certainly didn't know the word abuse, and I don't think I knew molestation. Like, I just didn't. It was such a different time. So I remember telling my mom I don't want to go to school. My dad was out to sea, and I had stomach aches, and I was crying and headaches, and that was something that never happened. I loved school. And so I just, you know, I say that because I want people that are parents that are listening, like, listen to your children if their behavior changes dramatically.
Right. Yeah. Yes. So. Big time. So share a little bit more about the program. Actually, I was very interested in the HURT program that you created. Share a bit more about that.
Yeah, so this HURT model was a great way of kind of understanding why we repeat what we do and then the outcomes that can occur versus where if you start this idea of, oh, I need to really look at my pattern. So let's say I have a lot of people that come to see me for a variety of different reasons, but let's just take what I started with. You know, I want bioidentical hormone replacement. And when I say, do you like your partner? And then I get tears. Well, there's this past betrayal, right? So at that juncture, you know, when I say, okay, the hormones aren't going to really help this, what I do is say, okay, let's take a look at how that betrayal event that you experience has impacted you over the last 5 years on a hormonal level. So let's check those. Let's look at your adrenals. Let's look at, you know, cellular mitochondrial health. I always do genetics on every one of my patients because I want to know what are the neurotransmitter genetic markers that can actually get dysregulated, right? And then if somebody says I'm depressed, I'm anxious, I can't sleep, I have no libido, then I'll also do some neurotransmitter testing. And then I start asking the questions along the emotional mental level, which is, okay, so when's the first, well, first of all, I usually start with your husband had an affair. And so when you talk about that right now, close your eyes and what feeling comes up. And so we find the feeling, where does it live in your body? You know, give it a color, give it a shape, give it a texture, and then drop in like, okay, what feeling is associated with it? Despair or sadness or anger, whatever it is. And so then we'll go back to when's the first time you can remember feeling that feeling. And it definitely will not be an adult event, right?
Fascinating.
And you know this. I mean, this is what I think the most profound learning that most adults get out of this is because they really want to focus in on that betrayal of adulthood as being the initiatory hurt, right?
Yeah.
And it never is, you know?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so then you go back to when's the first time you can remember, and, you know, if you just stay with the feeling and not the behavior, then it can be, there are a whole variety of things will come out. And so we work with that and healing that. Because remember, the meaning, the belief, the behavior that I created at 10 was perfectionism, right? I have to be perfect to even survive. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for those outmoded, outdated meaning, belief, behavior patterns that are showing up. Because, you know, hubby came along, had an affair, was out of integrity with his vows of marriage, definitely screwed up, hurt her, but 5 years later, not being able to move through and repair in spite of all of the work that they'd done together was because there was something deeper, right? And so we had to go back and heal that, reframe, rewire the brain, move it through and out the body. And then we could start working on the thing that happened 5 years ago. And then she can start to actually get back into a relationship sexually with herself and her partner. So sex at that point for her was just a withholding currency. You know, wow. You hurt me, so I'm going to hurt you. David Snarch has this, he's one of my family and sex therapy teachers, and he talks about a high desire partner and a low desire partner, and that in every relationship there's a high desire partner and a low desire partner for everything. I'm the high desire partner in my marriage for dogs. like my husband's not really a pet person, right? So I'm the dog person. I'm the high desire partner in our marriage for hiking and exercising and getting outdoors, right? He's not. He's a meditator. He would do like nothing better than to sit all day long on his butt, right? And so he's the high desire partner for having a really, really tight budget in our family. He's the high desire partner for sex. He's, you know, so when you kind of can figure that out, you'll start to understand that it's always, a relationship is always a negotiation. And so if it's not explicit that marriage is always a negotiation, then what happens is when something, you know, when the high desire partner for sex is not getting their needs met, then they'll start being the low desire partner for something that you want, okay? So it'll start getting very
right?
And it becomes just a leverage point or a currency that's being used to regain power. So in her case, it wasn't that she wasn't really, didn't have libido. She had no vitality on so many different levels, right? So in Ayurvedic medicine, they talk about this word called ojas, O-J-A-S, which is really life force vitality. It's the same as jin in Chinese medicine. So you're born with a certain amount of that, and when you burn through it, you die. Like, that's how they talk about it. And it's very hard to replenish. They conceptualize it like a golden drop of honey, which actually, Dr. Gerald Pollack, who I interview every couple of years or so, he's from the University of Washington, does all this amazing research on water.
Yep.
And he talks about, you know, easy water, which is a fourth state of water, which actually is exactly what Ayurveda talks about from all those centuries ago.
Amazing. That's amazing. I did not know that.
Right? Yeah, he and I geeked out about that one day when I was interviewing for my radio show. I was like, oh my gosh, that's ojas, you know?
That's amazing.
I know.
That's amazing, yeah.
So if you, that's the part, you know, that vitality that your cells can actually uptake and be hydrated and fed and nourished. You know, Emoto talked about this with water, with if you yell at your water, then it's going to molecularly change and it's not going to hydrate you and nourish you. You know, if you play beautiful music and you talk sweetly to it, it's going to have a different molecular structure to integrate with you. So that's actually how ojas is too. So
wow.
You burn through your ojas if you have no self-love, right? A self-love deficit, as you talk about. And if you're constantly feeling like you're being victimized in life, then that's going to be another place where you're going to deplete your ojas. So I started thinking about this, you know, when I was in grad school, of, gosh, we just don't even have an English word for ojas. It just doesn't really grab it, right? And I started thinking, actually, libido does, because libido comes from the word desire, which in Latin means from the stars, you know, and from the stars for me is like, it's your gift from that you are to the world, right? It's your dharma, your life purpose. It's the force and the vitality that you have to actually execute that, to be able to live it and to achieve what you came here to do. And so libido level can be a measurement of that, kind of like a idiot light on, you know, a gauge on your dashboard of your car. And when you're driving along on your gas is getting down to E, you don't just push the gas pedal down and expect to go further and faster forever. You actually know you have to stop over at a filling station and take care of your car. But we don't seem to do that for ourselves, right? So our little gauge comes down and we reach for an energy drink, you know, a Red Bull or something like that, or coffee or some short-chain carbohydrate, or smoke weed or do something to actually, you know, change the way that we're feeling instead of addressing what the body's trying so hard to convey, right?
Yeah, I think you've sort of gone in a direction that I exactly wanted to ask you about as well. Because when we talk about sexual energy, it is so much, talking about it from an energetic perspective, like the masculine and the feminine energy, and how, you know, when we're alive and vital, it's a sensual experience, and it means that there's energy flow, there isn't blockages in the body. And what I what I find really interesting is I think there's been an epidemic. Unfortunately, what can take that away from us? Early life stress and trauma will. It's like a virus. We get that stolen from us. That beautiful, sort of vital, sensual energy that can get stolen from us, and then we're forever looking to replace that from in the outside world.
It's not necessarily that it's stolen from us. We actually give it away.
Oh, yes, that too.
Because of the agreements yes. that we create, right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So we create this agreement, I'll take care of you. In fact, I'll be overly caring toward you if you'll just like acknowledge that I have a need and maybe read me, which of course is impossible, right? Or I'll do this thing perfectly, or I'll, you know, it's the five love languages, right? So many different ways of conceptualizing this, the Enneagram, the five love languages. But the thing that what we're doing is we have to realize that that strategy that we're using to give it away was something we created in childhood under duress when we were being traumatized.
Yes.
And we can define what that means, because everybody's had trauma and we probably need to talk about what that means. But that's where we start giving our life force away.
Yes.
And for then numbing out behaviors that we create, maybe one of the things Ayurveda says, like for men who masturbate all the time, they're actually getting rid of their ojas, right? So that's where in Eastern philosophy, this idea of recycling your energy came from. And it's been, you know, it's been called Tantra in the West. And actually, Tantra is my spiritual path, and that is not that. But it's actually a different kind of thing, where Tantra is actually, it literally means the web, the weave, the warp of life, and that every single thing is actually God. Everything's God. Your trauma is God. You know, death is God. Birth is God. Everything that happens to you that you judge and deem and categorize as good is God. And also the things you deem and judge and categorize as bad is God. Like, all of it is. And so when you're in that space, you have more ojas, because you're recognizing that, oh, car accident that I just had 2 days ago, that too was God. That was me being tapped on the shoulder, like, you need to get more mindful, you know? And so it's always being in that space where sex is God too, which is where in the United States we've gone completely awry, you know, from the pulpits across the United States, desire is deemed and judged as a sin, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think that exactly this in the wider picture, the shame around sex, the shame around masturbation. I hate that word. It's such a, it's not a good word. It should be called self-love, something like that.
Self-pleasuring, self-pleasuring.
Yeah. You know, it's the kind of mass consciousness and the belief systems around sex. And it should be really part of the discussion around health completely, because it's so essential. It's just this relationship with others and with ourselves on a sexual male, female level is the foundation of health at the deepest level, including the ability to have self-love. If you have shame around something as foundational as sex, for example, that's just not a foundation to build a happy life or health.
So I started this whole new branch of medicine called functional sexology. I'm the mother of functional sexology, which I always say makes me the, you know, mother fucker. She's the one, you know, from Meet the Fockers, right? I'm very
That's great.
One day I did this Facebook post. I was looking around my house at some of the things we have, you know, and thinking about it from my children's perspective. They're going through school, and I'm like, oh, I'm just like Mrs. Fokker. But functional sexology, people will say to me, so first of all, what is that, you know? And I always say it's finding and fixing the blocks to your flow. You know, it's really like the flow for anything. It's not necessarily just sexual. It's your desire for life. There's this really, really amazing story that is one of the only ones that's ever come out of the Judeo-Christian tradition that a colleague of mine, her name's Dr. Tina Sherman Sellers, found. And she was looking for sex positive stories that came out of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And she found this one in an ancient Hebrew text. And the way the story goes is it was Jerusalem in a very, very early time. And the King Solomon's temple was there. And the rabbis were starting to notice that the citizens of the town were starting to become very, very libidinous, they would say, is what the term was, which means there was a lot of fornication, right? So one of the sins. And so God, can you please take away this energy, you know, this energy that drives people to behave in such horrible, sinful ways. And so God said, are you sure you want me to do that? You know, and they said, yes. Thank you for answering, you know. And so one of the rabbis witnessed this lion of fire. It was like the go over the wall of Jerusalem and off into the desert. And they said, oh, good. Okay. Now the people will become more saintly, you know, and more religious and more tuned into God, and we'll have a better environment here to raise our children in. So over the days, they loved what was happening, you know. But then as the week started to progress, hens stopped laying eggs and cows stopped giving milk and artists stopped creating and no building was happening. And, you know, like nothing creative, no music, nothing. And they started seeing everything really just dying, you know, because all that creative energy had left. So they went back in the Holy of Holies and they said, okay, please come back, Jehovah. So, and they said, you know, can we just get half dose? And, you know, and God said, no, you have it. And then you have to behave responsibly with it. And so they said, all right, you know, and then everything came back to life. And I love that story because it's, you know, desire's not a sin. It's just learning how to behave responsibly, right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. There's so much to be healed within the culture, because we are, that's what we're talking about with this type of expanding out, you know, the source of thinking about health from this perspective. It becomes a cultural thing, and it even hits religion and values and everything, right? It's so true. Something I wanted to just dive back into, because it was really interesting, this idea, because it's so crucial, that you were saying about women will be looking at some event in their adulthood about, it doesn't have to be just as, you know, a kind of partnership relation thing, it could be anything, but where it's something that's in adulthood, and then you asking the question, but when did you first have this feeling, and you take that back to childhood. That's incredibly powerful, and I didn't want to let it go, because it's also usually, from my understanding, is like we have some event that happens in childhood and there's a wound, so there's an emotion that needs to be released, so we'll keep attracting events that trigger that emotion until it will get released, so that we face up to it and heal the original.
And what we're attracting to us is teachers, right? And they're not bad. So, right. You know, you may have had someone that you call your asshole ex-narcissistic husband, you know, and you as an empath, nurturing, beautiful caregiver are just like, finally got rid of that, you know, horrible, toxic vampire, you know? But really, yeah, at the core of it, what you had attracted was also God and was your teacher, right? To be able to learn to set good boundaries, to be able to learn to advocate for yourself, to be able to learn to understand your value without having it reflected back to you. That's one great thing about being with a narcissist, is that they won't reflect your value back to you. You know, they don't know how to read you. They can only read themselves and see their own value, and they don't have empathy. So what's the utility of that? Oh, this amazing ability for you to finally check that developmental level that needed to happen a long time ago and didn't because of trauma, right?
Yeah.
And it's never too late. So all of the people that come into your life, all the events, all the experiences then become these incredible catalysts for growth and learning, and probably doing some retroactive, right, learning that needed to happen at different developmental levels that didn't. And so that's what I really want to kind of reframe it, because yes, thank God that you don't have that relationship anymore, and hopefully you got what you needed from it so that you don't attract five more of them, right?
Yes. So you can learn the lesson once and for all, which Yes, it's very interesting. Actually, I wanted to also just if you can speak to this issue about confronting the self, because we've talked about this on a previous interview, but I don't think we talked about it on this interview yet. So, because it's a really important step, isn't it? With psychology work that you're trying to address, a health issue, and you realized, wow, it's actually I need to look at something emotional. Would you say this is the top number one thing required for that? Is this ability to self-confront?
Well, I always say that there are two most important words in the English language, the way I see it right now in my own developmental state, is first of all, willingness. Willingness to self-confront, willingness to be able to take a look at all the teachers that have come to you in your life, be able to see yourself in them, and we can talk about that in a minute. That's the reflective mirror work. And then the second most important word is integration. Is being able to take what you learn in any given circumstance, whether it's in a plant medicine journey or it's a psychology appointment or it's from a disease or an interaction you have with somebody interrelationally, that you can then take that insight and then integrate it, right? So we can be a lot like Teflon, where things we can see it and then it just kind of smoothly runs right off of us. But if we're willing to take it in and really start doing the work to integrate and go into your next developmental state, which is a hard work, that's why the willingness word's so important. And the thing that I see that triggers that is what I call the misery to motivation ratio. Unfortunately, human nature seems to be, and I definitely fell into this category, that the more miserable you are, the more motivated you are to actually do this work. Right?
Right.
Yeah. If you're not
Right.
miserable, if you're just slightly annoyed or frustrated, you're actually not as willing to go in and really do the self-confrontation work, really do the integration work, But if you're really miserable, then usually there's a higher degree of motivation.
I used to talk about people not being sick enough to do the work. Like, wow, this is crazy. Yeah, that's crazy. So, is there anything else that you wanted to also you think is important that you also wanted to share about your own journey or a message for people as well?
Well, we kind of said that we would come back around and circle around and talk about why we think everybody has trauma.
Oh yeah.
I want to make sure that we do that.
Yes. It's yeah, the prevalence of that. And yeah, I mean, it's nobody gets out of childhood without having some degree of trauma, basically, and people might not realize that.
So there are a couple kinds of trauma you could think about, like capital T trauma, which is the stuff that everybody thinks about, hurricane, war, sexual, emotional, physical, domestic violence abuse, like the adverse childhood events study that talked about neglect and abandonment and, all of that we think of as like capital T trauma. And then there's the lowercase t trauma. And this is really interesting because when I was doing my doctoral work, I was looking at a lot of fMRI scans of brains. And what I found, and it was really fascinating because as I was mapping these brains and I was looking at them next to what I was seeing in the research about what parts of the brain light up when women have sexual desire, I went, oh my gosh. And I have the slide and it's the same parts of the brain that are hijacked from PTSD or lowercase t trauma, and we'll talk about that in a second, are the same parts of the brain needed for a woman to feel desire.
Wow.
So this won't happen, right? If your brain's lit up in a trauma cycle. Now, again, people will kind of go, well, thank God I didn't have trauma. So a researcher by the name of Moll and their team actually took a look at the brain changes that happen with big capital T trauma and found that we actually get brain damage. We have a shrinkage in our prefrontal cortex. We have an engorgement or an enlargement in the volume of our amygdala and the limbic system, is particularly on the right side of it, that fight or flight response, right? And so that was well known in people that had PTSD, but what they found was that people that were reporting chronic daily stress had the same exact brain changes and biochemical changes as people with PTSD. Now, so
Wow.
on the perceived stress scale, if that was chronic, if someone comes and says, I'm overwhelmed, so I would say, overwhelmed, like the gateway drug for perfectionism. It's just flaring and showing you that your perfectionism is out. Overwhelm will change your brain in the same way that sexual abuse does.
Wow. When you say overwhelm, you say chronic stress, do you mean like the thing about rushing around, answering emails, picking up the kids?
Actually, let me answer it, because this is really important. The word here to not forget is perceived.
Right.
Doesn't even matter what it is.
Yes, very right? important.
It's perceived stress. So it can be anything, right? It's your perception. When I give talks, I have this whole diagram I use where, you know, there's a person, and then you have this perception, and this comes from Ayurveda, of how you're viewing your world. And then what that does is when it hits your mind, you know, is this a stressful situation? So I always tell people, like, I'm one of the busiest people that you will ever meet. And I don't consider myself stressed and overwhelmed. I consider myself living in the flow of my dharma. Like, this is what I'm meant to do. I love it, you know?
Yes, yes.
So my biochemistry matches that, because there's nothing up here that's saying that I'm in survival mode, or I'm not going to make it, or it's too much. I'm on bread and I'm peanut butter and I'm ripping it and I'm spread too thin, you know? Like, all of that. That overburdened, overscheduled overwhelm is a perception of your life being too much, right?
Yes, yeah.
And that can fall in any category.
Yes. No, yeah. So that's a really important point, because all the studies of stress always say it's perceived stress, that it's not the actual events, not the physical circumstances. So that's, yes, exactly. So this has been absolutely fascinating. I've loved hearing your story. You've shared really tremendous, important information as well. It's very enlightening. Any final comments that you want to add about the level of trauma, the epidemic of trauma that we have in general? Any other comments on that, and any final kind of words of wisdom that you might have?
Well, the sort of pithy word of wisdom I'll leave is that what's in your head goes to your bed. So, you know, like, whatever your
okay,
whatever your perception of your life is, follows you into bed.
Right.
And so ultimately, it's not, you're not broken, you're not frigid, you don't have something wrong with you. There's nothing wrong. It's just another data point. Okay. If you're attracting people to you that can't seem to read you, this is something women do all the time, right? If he really loved me, he would know, and I wouldn't have to tell him what I need, you know, or when I say, so what does help you have an orgasm? I don't know. Well, then how in the world is anyone else going to know, right? You have to know you first. And so again, what's in your head goes to your bed, and the lack thereof also, you know? So being able to articulate your needs, to know yourself, to love yourself, to know that, you know, the people that you attract to you, to be able to have good boundaries with them, and then also to be able to show up and see and be seen, that shows up as the quality of your sex life.
Yep. And it also shows up in your health, right?
Absolutely. It shows up in every arena. It shows up in your bank account. And so, you know, good sex comes from good communication, but scrape you off the ceiling sex comes from scrape you off the ceiling amazing communication. And that's going to be true for anything, right?
That's profound. This has been so good. It's so important. It's such an important topic to address for people to have, you know, to get their health back. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Dr. Keisha. It's been awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, everybody.